Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And we're going to begin this Tuesday after Memorial Day with a look at America's long war in the Middle East. Some would say America's permanent war. Andrew Basevich, a retired Boston University professor, calls it a hopeless war that has stretched on for close to 40 years, from Beirut to Bosnia, from Iraq to Afghanistan, from Libya to Pakistan, from President Jimmy Carter to President Barack Obama. It's a war that America is still fighting, and Basevich says it's not working, and it's time to stop it and rethink our approach to this part of the world. Andrew Basevich is a retired Army colonel. He lost his son fighting in Iraq in 2007. He taught history and international relations at BU, and his new book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, a Military History, and he's with us now. And Professor Basevich, always great to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you.
So you date the start of this long war back to 1980 when President Jimmy Carter used his State of the Union address and declared the Persian Gulf was part of the U.S. vital interest. What led Carter to make this commitment, and what has the effect been?
Well, the effect, and it's an effect that Carter himself did not anticipate, my judgment. The effect was to inaugurate the militarization of U.S. policy in the Islamic world. I think it's important to remember that prior to that time, prior to 1980, there were really two parts of the world that the United States considered worth fighting for, both in the context of the Cold War. We were willing to fight for Western Europe, and we are willing to fight for East Asia, indeed had done so, both in Vietnam and Korea. But prior to 1980, there was no significant U.S. military presence or commitment, not even any serious contingency plans that would see the U.S. sending troops into the Islamic world. So that changes beginning in 1980, again with consequences that I think Carter didn't foresee. Why did he act? I think there were domestic political reasons and there were foreign policy issues. You know, domestically, you'll recall, 1980 was an election year. Carter was viewed as a very vulnerable incumbent, and I think he calculated that as he approached the election in November, anticipating that Ronald Reagan was going to be his opponent, he needed to look tough. And why did he need to look tough? He needed to look tough because recent developments had exposed him to the criticism of being weak, two in particular. One was the Iranian Revolution, the overthrow of the Shah, with Iran going from being an ally into an adversary. And equally important, the December 1979 Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which gave the impression, falsely, but gave the impression that the Soviet Union was on the march, and from Afghanistan they were going to take Iran and they were going to take Saudi Arabia. So the president declared the Persian Gulf a vital U.S. national security interest, and that set in motion a military misadventure that, in my judgment, continues down to the present day.
And so this is what's so interesting about the history that you've written, because it's almost as if, you know, the United States has been engaged in, I'm sure some people would argue this. I mean, there was Beirut, there's Kuwait, there's Afghanistan, Iraq, on and on it goes. But why do you view this as one long war as opposed to a series of conflicts? In other words, what ties them all together?
Sure. And first of all, I think that most Americans, to the extent that they attend at all to these varied interventions going back to 1980, do tend to see them as disparate events, right, unrelated. And you can do that. But I think if you do that, then you do miss the larger significance of our failure, to use a term I think is appropriate. But what connects them, I think, ultimately what connects them is that beginning in 1980, policymakers, and to some degree Americans in general, fell for the notion that the adroit use of American military power was somehow or other going to fix the place. And so we have been experimenting with ways of employing U.S. military power ever since. We've tried You mentioned Beirut. You know, we've tried peacekeeping. We've tried regime change. We've tried invade, occupy, and nation building. We've tried counterinsurgency. We've tried counterterrorism. We've tried a wide variety of methods. And when you look at the narrative of 40 years, and you ask what I think is the fundamental question, how are we doing? Mm. Is it getting better? Can we see some ultimate success out there on horizon? You know, the answer is we're not doing well. We're not succeeding. And, you know, some people could say, well, we just need to try harder and there'll be some light at the end of the tunnel. My judgment it would be that we've been trying now for going on 36 years and there is no success in the offing. So perhaps it's time to engage in a fundamental reevaluation of our approach to the region.
And I want to talk to you about exactly what you mean by that. But I want to stick to this idea of we've been trying this for 36 plus years and it hasn't worked. What about if I were to say to you, so Saddam Hussein at one point invades Kuwait. The first President Bush initiates Operation Desert Storm, goes in. It's quick. It's decisive. Massive force. He liberates Kuwait, comes back home. Was that a success? Along the way, have there been successful military interventions?
Along the way, there have been successes in an operational sense.
Yeah.
If we evaluate Operation Desert Storm as a distinct entity, in many respects, it was a brilliantly executed campaign, one in which President George Herbert Walker Bush orchestrated an equally impressive diplomatic context. We didn't fight alone in that one.
Mm-hmm.
We got other people to foot the bill so that fiscally we probably came out ahead. However, put it in a somewhat larger context, that really wasn't the first Gulf War. There was a Gulf War between 1980 and 1988. We remember it as the Iran-Iraq War. What we don't remember is that the United States was involved in that war on behalf of Saddam Hussein.
Hmm.
That we were engaged in a fight against Iran. And indeed, the outcome of that war in which we were participants really set the stage then for Saddam's actions in August of 1990 when he invaded and annexed Kuwait. Furthermore, if you look just a little bit beyond the operational success of Desert Storm and ask the question, well, what came next? The notion of a clean outcome is, it ain't there. Because what comes next is a U.S. intervention on behalf of the Kurds who are being beat up by Saddam. Why is he beating up on them? Because Saddam has been able to retain his place in power, leading to a sustained U.S. military commitment justified by the need now to contain mm-hmm. Saddam Hussein. So it's not as if we won a great victory and then we were able to come home. I mean, we didn't. The troops did come home and they had their parades, but there was a residual presence that then led to other further unintended, unanticipated consequences, not least among them, this guy named Osama bin Laden, who takes offense at the fact that U.S. forces are now permanently stationed in Saudi Arabia.
Hmm. It's interesting. I mean, I'm so interested to ask one more question about Operation Desert Storm because it disagree with me, but it seemed to me, sort of observing that point in history, that in a way, it was a pivotal war because, in a way, it's when we were able to vanquish the ghosts of Vietnam, in a way. I mean, it was a military operation that, as you just suggested, was very successful on an operational level. And it sort of proved the idea that we could use overwhelming force and win. And it seemed to almost set the table for the interventions that followed.
Well, I think you're exactly right. And in that sense, that there's an ironic result of the victory. Yes, we vanquished the ghosts of Vietnam. George Herbert Walker Bush famously says we kicked the Vietnam syndrome, meaning we'll no longer feel restrained with regard to the use of force.
Yeah.
But what comes out of that period of time is an exaggerated confidence in the ability of the United States to use force. That, and I think, really comes to fruition in the wake of 9/11, when George Herbert Walker Bush's son is president, George Herbert Walker Bush's defense secretary is vice president. When they decide that a preventive war targeting Saddam Hussein is going to set the stage for a broader transformation of the greater Middle East. They expected in 2003 a decisive, cheaply won victory because of their reading of the outcome of the war back in 91. Mm-hmm. Of course, they didn't get that cheap victory. What they got was a quagmire. So things connect in ways that are more often than not are really ironic.
So looking at 36 years, close to 40 years of this endless war, you conclude, when you look at this history and this history of events, of skirmishes, of interventions, of targeted assassinations, of outright war, that it has failed. So what's the alternative? Just pull out, go home? What are you proposing?
No, not pull out, go home. But to emphasize, I mean, this is not a policy book. This is a military history
right.
book. It's trying to
Got
tell
it.
The story of U.S. military involvement. And I do believe that a prerequisite to devising a different approach is to acknowledge the failure of the approach we've been taking.
Yeah.
So point number one simply is, trying harder is probably not going to result in long-term success. So as a policy analyst, what do I think we ought to do? First of all, we need to evaluate realistically the actual threat. I mean, as you and I are speaking, there's a great hullabaloo about ISIS. And ISIS is a vicious organization that needs to be taken on. But ISIS doesn't represent any serious threat to the United States of America. You know, they got no air force, they got no navy, they got no weapons of mass destruction, they've got no allies. They are probably 25 in round numbers, 1,000 relatively lightly armed, vicious killers, but they're 7,000 miles away. And I think the issue there is, rather than assuming that there's a need to project power to keep America safe, to use that phrase, mm-hmm. we're wiser to think about what do we need to do to defend ourselves, to protect ourselves from this limited threat.
But I could imagine someone hearing that argument and saying, what, so just let ISIS sort of, I mean, I take your
no.
point that they're not a threat out there 7,000 miles away now, but just let them continue
no,
to sort
I
don't, of...
And if I may, I think the problem is that so often
yeah.
the conversation gets posed in sort of this binary format that either we've got to fight on until the end of time, or I guess that means we're withdrawing and we're just going to let things happen. And I think there are other choices. And I think the way to begin identifying an additional choice is to ask the basic question, who is threatened by ISIS? Because ISIS does pose an existential threat to the nations in the region,
mm-hmm.
to Iran and Iraq and Saudi Arabia, to Turkey. And it seems to me that the diplomatic task, and let me emphasize, I'm not trying to suggest that this is something the State Department could do in the next 48 hours. The diplomatic task is to persuade those nations in the region who are facing an existential threat to make common cause against that threat.
Right.
To set aside their differences, which are serious, in recognition of the fact that there is this transcendent problem where they have a common interest in collaborating.
To what extent, in your view of the history, has President Obama changed the course at all? Or has he changed the course at all? Because I know, as we know, he ran for president with an intent on not being a wartime president. He has ended up being a two-term wartime
right.
president. But still, as he articulated at one point, you know, the policy of, you know, not doing stupid things. He hasn't
right.
committed large numbers of troops. He stayed out of Syria. I mean, to what extent does he represent a sort of shift?
Well, I don't think he has stayed out of Syria. It seems to me that we are tippy-toeing into Syria. But that said, the president learned and maybe it's an obvious lesson, but it's not a trivial one. President learned that invading and occupying countries with an expectation that we can somehow transform them into liberal democracies is a losing proposition. What he has attempted to do is devise alternatives to invade and occupy, and that's where we get sort of the Obama approach of targeted assassinations, special operations forces, relying on air power, training local forces in hopes of getting them to take up the fight. And the result is, and it's again, it's something to be noted and appreciated, is that the cost imposed upon the United States for continuing this war under Obama are less than the costs were back in the George W. Bush days. Less money being spent, less American lives, but frankly, not necessarily better outcomes. And so he has been a two-term war president and hasn't done all that well. I think that the determining factor in Obama's legacy in this region is going to be determined by how the Iran nuclear deal plays out. I don't think the Iran nuclear deal is particularly about preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. I think that the real rationale, the underlying unspoken rationale, is to end the isolation of Iran with the hope, and it's a very much a hope that remains to be, we'll see how it plays out over time, with the hope that Iran can become a responsible actor in the region. Should it choose to follow that course, then that notion that I just referred to of local actors restabilizing the region becomes at least somewhat more plausible.
This idea, though, that 40 years of various forms of warfare have not worked, I mean, it really, you make a strong and compelling case to, as you have articulated, you know, to think of some other way. But I'm at a loss as to sort of figure out how that would work, because I guess I'm thinking of the argument that we've been involved in a big way. We have created all kinds of sort of upset in the region,
right,
with all kinds of effects. So in a sense, you know, it's the Pottery Barn mantra. You know, you break it, you it's yours, and you got to stay there and fix it. So I'm worried. I'm unclear how we extricate ourselves, I guess.
Well, I mean, let me not suggest that somehow it's going to be easy, but let me suggest that both morally,
yeah,
and pragmatically, simply to persist in a failed policy, because extricating yourself from the mess you've made is difficult, strikes me as a pretty suspect proposition. Now, I have to say, because here we are in the middle of a presidential campaign, neither of the two likely candidates, as I listen to them, seems particularly inclined to even consider any form of different approach or different policy. Clinton and Trump are differ from one another in a host of ways, but both of them basically ignore this narrative that I describe in my book, focus on the latest manifestation of violence, ISIS, and basically argue, elect me president, and I'm gonna nail these guys.
Yeah.
There's an underlying issue here, I think. And one of the underlying issues is the insistence that's been particularly prominent in the Washington foreign policy establishment since the end of the Cold War, that there is no alternative to American global leadership. That if we're not there, wherever, if right, we're not there, things are going to go to hell in a handbasket. Well, we have been there in the greater Middle East. Things have gone to hell in a handbasket. Not entirely our fault. We didn't create the political dysfunction and the local animosities, but we've made matters worse.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that it is therefore incumbent upon us to find a different way out. And ultimately, that will require obliging local actors to take take primary responsibility for the security and the stability of the region. Ain't going to happen overnight. Probably would be a project that would extend across at least the first term of the next president, but it needs to be it needs to be done.
The last issue I want to, and we only have about a minute and a half left, but I want to just ask you about this because I was so struck by something that you wrote. I'm not sure it was in the book. It was it was in a piece you wrote for a newspaper, and you came up with this wonderful line: "Culture shapes the American way of war," and you made the point that unlike, for example, the Civil War or World War II, there was a certain buy-in on the part of Americans that sort of defined the kind of wars we fought. That isn't the case today. And in a way, that allows things to continue to drift, if I'm reading you correctly, in the way that they have for the past 40 years, because so few Americans are really paying attention to what's going on.
No question about it. I mean, this really deserves a far longer conversation.
Yeah.
Because we're touching on the question of who serves and who sacrifices,
right.
and as many others have noted, the reliance on the so-called all-volunteer force, our professional military, has allowed the American people to detach themselves from these wars with insidious consequences.
Yeah. Well, Andrew Bacevich, it's always a great pleasure to have you. Thank you for coming in and talking about these important issues. Retired professor of history, international relations at Boston University, Andrew Bacevich's most recent book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Thanks so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, a preview of the House debate tomorrow on the Massachusetts transgender bill. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.